Welcome to Foraging, a podcast in environmental humanities. In this series, we invite emerging and confirmed voices in history, anthropology and social sciences to share their ongoing research with us. We want to shed light on how the groundbreaking, critical work challenges anthropocentric biases in the humanities. We want you to get inspired by their experiences, the methods, the conceptual frameworks. And we aim together to explore new ways of doing science and to find hope in the Anthropocene. My name is Benoît Henriet. I am professor of history at the Vrije Universiteit Brussels and the principal investigator of the Foragency project, Foraging, Colonialism and Modern Human Agency in Central Africa. This project is funded by a European Research Council starting grant and is hosted by the research group SHOCK, Social History of Capitalism, at the Vrije Universiteit Brussels. For the first episode of Foraging, we are very lucky to welcome Diogo de Carvalho Cabral. Diogo is assistant professor in environmental history at Trinity College Dublin, and he obtained his PhD at the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro, where he also studied geography and history. For the past 15 years, he has been working on the environmental history and historical geography of Brazil, with a particular focus on the pre-industrial period. Diogo is a fascinating voice in modern human history. He has produced groundbreaking research on the relationship between leaf-cutting ants and human communities in 19th century Amazon, which has been published among others in the prestigious journal Environmental History. I recommend you to read this article, which has been a key source of inspiration for the Foragency team. Diogo also edited together with André Vasquez-Vital and Margarita Gascon the fascinating volume Modern Human Histories of Latin America and the Caribbean, published by the University of London Press. My discussion with Diogo today is about this recent publication, his own academic trajectory, and his encounter with environmental history and modern human approaches, as well as about the new frontiers and ongoing challenges of doing environmental humanities. My first question would be, why and how did you become an historian, and what led you towards environmental history?
Thank you so much, Benoît, for having me here, for the invitation to do the podcast. Becoming a historian. I have to be honest, I don't really know if I am a historian. There is this thing that happened to me because, you know, my first training was in, my first and major training actually is in geography, right? And my only official training in history is a master's, right? Of which I'm really proud. I'm not downplaying it, but it's, you know, it's kind of a minor thing in my training. And when I was doing my master's, I kind of heard from people in the department saying, yeah, what this guy does is not really history. And I was like, okay, right. And then I had to go back to geography to get my PhD. And there in the geography department, I heard, yeah, you know, in my defense, in my viva, yeah, you know, this is kind of all right, but what you're doing here is not exactly geography, is it? So there is, I don't really know what I do. What I do know is that I have a huge interest in the past and in the relations between what we call people, what we call humans, and what we call perhaps a term, an expression I use very often is the rest of the biosphere, right? And I always had this huge fascination, this passion, which comes from geography, really, of bridging the divide, right, between what we traditionally see as culture or society or humans, whatever, and nature, the environment, or whatever you want to call it, right, the extra humanity. And this is an old dream of geographers to bridge this divide. Some could argue an unrealized dream, but I never cease to believe that it's possible to do it. And you know, this, of course, environmental history itself, but newer approaches such as the so-called modern human history approach is a amazing promise that we can bridge this divide in especially non-positivistic ways, non-mechanistic ways, in ways that really capture the entanglement, the co-constitution between beings, human, non-human, cultural, natural, whatever you want to call
it. This is precisely exactly what I wanted to ask you, because, you know, environmental history exists as a field for more than 40 years now, in earnest, even a bit more than that. And these more than human, so-called more than human approaches have been, you know, coming in full force in the last decade or so. And I was wondering, how do you see the divide between those two approaches? What makes more than human history or humanities is different from environmental history? And why did you choose this more than human history framework for the edited volume that you are that you have recently published?
This question kind of haunts so-called more than human historians. I recall this recent paper by Emily O'Gorman, who actually wrote one of the conceptual papers that we have kind of outlining more than human history. And in this paper, not the original one, a later one, he touches on this question, right? You know, how different is this from environmental history, right? I would argue that, if I remember correctly, Emily argues something similar, that there is not, you know, there is not an abyss, of course, between environmental history and more than human history. But I would argue that more than human historians emphasize more seriously the co-constitution thing, right? They take more seriously, I'd say, Bruno Latour's claim that culture and nature are points, you know, we need to explain how they came about rather than taking that as points of departure for our analysis, right? And if you go through, you know, most of environmental history, the classics of environmental history, perhaps with the exception of, I don't know, a couple of books like William Cronin's Nature's Metropolis. But anyway, most works kind of take for granted culture and nature as stabilized, separate domains that interact, of course. They do interact. They do touch and change each other, but they kind of remain as separate domains, right?
And this, maybe it's the reason why you and your co-editors chose Decentering the Human in Environmental History as the subtitle for this book. It was about challenging this kind of nature-culture divide.
Absolutely, absolutely. That was the point. That was the point. It's so, yeah. So in a way, the more than human approach is a radicalization, in a sense. I don't know. Just came to my mind right now. This expression, the radicalization of the environmental, the original environmental history project, right? To really question the boundaries, these ontological boundaries. Is there a nature? Is there a society? Or we should just scramble everything up and just trace the linkages, the networks, as Latour would have it, or the entanglements, or the interactions, right? But we wanted to radicalize environmental history approach in telling histories of Latin America. That was the attempt. I'm not really sure we achieved that goal, but that was really the intention. Yeah.
Okay. Can you maybe take us through the process that led to the publication of this edited volume on modern human histories of Latin America? Why was it timely? Why was it relevant? What was kind of the impetus that brought you to shoulder this project?
Yeah, it was initially something it was something I wanted to do for years, actually. It wasn't that concrete years ago, but I always had this instigation of doing something like that, of radicalizing the environmental history approach in telling histories of Latin America. And then at some point, I'm trying to do the genealogy of the whole thing here in my head. Anyway, I was working with this colleague of mine, this great scholar named André Vital, who works in Goiás, in the interior of Brazil, doing amazing stuff on animals, on water. His chapter on water and, you know, in animations are really, really fascinating. Anyway, we were doing some stuff, including conceptual work. And then I told him, what if we try to put together an edited volume, gathering, you know, people doing stuff similar to what we are doing, and focusing on the region, on Latin America as a region, Latin America and the Caribbean. When I say Latin America, I'm implicitly including the Caribbean, but some people, you know, like to explicitly say the Caribbean. Anyway, so I told him, what if we did that? And he was like, wow, yeah, that's a great idea. But we needed help. You know, this was a huge, huge project. And then we talked to this other colleague of ours, Margarita Gascon, who had been doing kind of more than human history of Latin America in her own way, dealing with natural disasters, dealing with resource frontiers, and then, you know, the kind of approach coalesced in terms of you know, this attempt to go deeper in eliciting the role of non-human beings and things in the constitution of Latin America, including, and this was a huge challenge we faced in the introduction, of kind of justifying, of explaining why to take something that is very often taken for granted, right? Latin America, right? And the Caribbean. Just as much as other world regions, right? Like Europe, like South Asia, like Oceania, whatever, right? These are, kind of a... There's this book called The Myth of Continents, making the argument that, you know, these meta geographies are to a great extent inventions, right? We use these spatial structures to comprehend the world, but we very often do not acknowledge this mediation, right? So anyway, so this was kind of the genealogy of the whole project. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's also very interesting what you say about, you know, taking such huge and also extremely biodiverse and environmentally diverse regions as a coherent unit of analysis. I was wondering, can you try to build maybe bridges towards, you know, the research of other historians or researchers in the humanities who are active in different geographic or of environmental areas? What can we learn from your approach, from taking, you know, Latin America and the Caribbean as a single unit of analysis, or a coherent one at least? And how can such an approach help us expand the field of environmental history?
Wow, what can I say about this? Well, in our case, we reflected about the adequateness, let's put it that way, of, to be honest, of course, 150% honest, of course, there is the pragmatism of doing something about a region that we inhabit. Well, I don't inhabit it any longer. Maybe I will come back, you know, go back to it. But a region, you know, that formed me as a body and soul. Although I do not like that dichotomy. Anyway, it's just a matter. It's just a way of expressing things. So there is a pragmatism of taking, you know, Latin America. We were always attached to it, you know, in sentimental terms. But analytically, it is hard to see a very hard cohesion in any region. Actually, in any region. So there is this is something that is, you know, it has been discussed in geography for ages, right? What is a region, right? Do regions need to have what degree of homogeneity does a region need to, does a region need in order to be a region, right? And the answer is, of course, it depends on the purpose and the method of your analysis, right? There are regions that are defined not so much by homogeneity, but by the functional process. For example, the hinterland of a city is a region. For example, Cronin's book on Chicago is a regional historical geography, in a sense, right? So anyway, it's always hard to assess the homogeneity and the adequateness of a region as an object of analysis. And in environmental history, you have to take into consideration many interrelated things. First of all, as you said, the non-human setting, right? How diverse is it? What kinds of landscapes and biomes do we encounter in this region? And the other element, of course, is human attachment to it, right? How do humans imagine this diversity? How do humans make sense of having, I don't know, grasslands and mountains and rainforests and you know, whatever in one region? How do they use these landscapes as part of their own internal life? How do they use it in terms of symbols, in terms of themes that they internalize into their social constitution, right? So this is always hard to analyze in terms of an ensemble, right? But what we try to argue is that there is this moving reality that we can call Latin America. And this moving reality is defined in terms of, for example, the socio-ecological relations established during colonization, European colonization. And then during the national period, we have different experiences of using the more than human world and being affected by the more than human world in constituting identities, national identities, and supranational identities. Right? We have authors, intellectuals, journalists, poets taking Latin America as a whole, as the setting and the living stage for their elaborations of identity, of intentions, of freedom, of sovereignty, right? I'm not sure if I answered your question, but I'm trying to reflect on the question you posed.
Maybe to go back to the challenges that are entailed by modern human histories in general, something that you discussed in the volume's introduction together with your co-editors, is that one of the main challenges maybe in bringing back this more than human dimension into historical narratives is the issue of working, you know, in a multidisciplinary way. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering maybe based on your experience, your own experiences, especially your work on, you know, the relationships between human and ants in 19th century Brazil, if you could help us, you know, advise aspiring or beginning environmental historians in how they should engage with life sciences. Where do they should start? What kind of approaches should they follow? What would be your advice? What would you have liked to know maybe when you started doing this research?
That's a great question. One concern I always have in mind is not to... Well, first of all, let me just say right away, it's hugely important to engage with scientists, so-called natural scientists or whatever you want to call it. Hugely important, right? The way you do it should be a concern. And the first concern is that we shouldn't be projecting, let's call it the images that we gather from reading scientific accounts, especially in the present. We shouldn't be projecting it back into our historical objects or subjects, more precisely. Ants or beavers or trees or whatever non-humans you're interested in, right? For the simple reason that if you do that, you're stripping your subjects, your historical subjects, of their historicity, right? You're just, you know, extrapolating back in time what we know now, in current days, right? So this is very important not to do that. At the same time, you need what scientists discover now in order to make some sense of what your non-human subjects were doing in the past. But there is this tension. You can't take current day findings for granted. You need to take them as indications, as something they might have done in the past. Right? Well, of course, there is the pragmatic assumption that, especially if you're working for, I was working with the 19th century, right? So if you have findings indicating that ants tend to do some stuff when confronted with certain circumstances, sometimes created by the experimenters, the scientists, right? And say, I don't know, in the late 20th century, there is, you know, a good chance that they, you know, would have done something similar, like in the late 19th century or whatever, right? But in any event, you must be critical. You must expect something different, right? After all, your job is to figure out what these beings were doing, what they did in the past, in a way, in a very concrete way, making their own lives and helping to change situations beyond their lives, right? So this means, in a way, that we should take scientific findings as another kind of source, mm-hmm. right? They shouldn't be seen as, something that... we take as authoritative, definitely authoritative, and that, you know, just we could just take these findings and project it back into the past. They are, as I said, indications that should be read with criticism, as we do with any source, really, right? These are the most important concerns for something interested in, pursuing that kind of analysis, in my perspective.
And I think that kind of bridges as well towards another issue to which environmental historians are confronted is sometimes the scarcity of information that we can find in historical records about more than human life. And I was wondering if you had any advice for, you know, young historians who are working into this field and who are struggling to find primary sources who can actually inform them on the history of non-humans. Where should you start with if you had to make a new research, you know? What kind of document would you like to consult, would you first consult in order to find this kind of archival thickness that would allow us to document the modern human life in the past?
I'm gonna say something from the perspective of someone interested in animals that had a very specialized branch of science dedicated to them, right? In this case, entomology, or even more precisely, myrmecology. Although myrmecology emerged in the early 20th century, if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, so from this perspective, of course, the obvious answer is start with the experts in those creatures, mm-hmm. right? This is the most obvious starting point, and I tend to do that, and not just because of, again, the authoritativeness of, oh yeah, they're experts, they know everything about it, but because they lived with these creatures. Of course, you can argue that, yeah, you know, non-scientists also lived all the time with ants, with crows, with tigers, whatever. Yeah, I know. But in terms of documentary record, scientists are the humans who, most often lived with these creatures and left written records about it, right? You know, other people, of course, they coexisted with animals, with plants. Yeah, but it's sometimes hard to find records that they produced in co-authorship. That's something I like to argue with these animals and even plants, and even you could argue the abiotic world. So I would start with scientists, naturalists, right? And this is something that is just occurring to me right now. But I think I did that instinctively, intuitively. It's a better word. But now it's surfacing as something more explicit from reading the entomologists, the naturalists, the experts. You're led to other sources because these guys, not so much in the late modern form of the paper, of the scientific paper, because the scientific paper tend to be very arid, mm-hmm. right? But more like naturalist reports, more like natural science was done in the 19th century in books and travel reports, that kind of thing. It gives you lots of tips in terms of the naturalist, the scientist saying that, yeah, I usually talk to, this person that hosts me in his house or her house. This person, for example, I don't know, is a huge coffee farmer, or important person in the town or whatever. You know, the naturalists' texts and sources, they very often lead you mm-hmm. to other kinds of records because it's kind of a node. Yeah. The naturalist is kind of a node in this socio-ecological network, in a sense, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a good starting point. It will branch out most often into other kinds of sources, right? But this is kind of it's part of the ongoing invention of the research itself, yeah. Every researcher will have this process of figuring out of branching out from this central place, which is the naturalist.
And I think that's something, maybe like a last question for our interview, is something that is kind of also related to the position of researchers who are doing environmental history or more than human history today. Mm-hmm. Because there was a recently published essay by Bache Bademut a couple of months ago in December 23, where she argues that environmental history used to be more activistic, but that since the 1970s and 1980s, since the early days of the field, environmental history has become more and more institutionalized, more and more legitimate as well, and that it has since then, and I quote her, has been retreating from engagement beyond the academy, that it has become a field that was much more concerned about, you know, like doing research and speaking towards a more limited audience of professional scholars, and which has been somehow less involved into any kind of form of activism for climate justice or to tackle climate change. And I was wondering, according to you, how can more than human history maybe still be mobilized in climate and or environmental activism? And what would you advise maybe to environmental historians who want to do something to kind of tackle the current multifaceted crisis? How could they mobilize their own research into this goal?
Yeah, well, I'm not 100% sure I agree. I do understand what she where she's coming from, Machiba, about the kind of retreating from activism. I think that it was kind of simpler, perhaps. It was more straightforward in the 70s and 80s to this link between activism and scholarship, right? And she's absolutely right that environmental history emerged from environmental activism. But then, as it expanded, right? Well, for example, in the 70s, there were what? A few practitioners in the field, right? In the late 90s, I would guess, I don't know, a few hundred more, if you consider, you know, the world. So it kind of naturally, wow, look at me, using nature anyway. It's harder to keep some kind of homogeneity in an expanding field, right? This is one point. And I don't think that there is a lesser concern with activism right now. For example, and you mentioned, of course, more than human history, there is a huge movement. Well, perhaps huge is an exaggeration, but anyway, there is a significant movement towards so-called rights of nature, mm-hmm. right? And this is something that is occurring at the political level, right? We've seen recently in the last decades, countries such as Ecuador and Bolivia to enshrine the rights of, well, the more than human world, right? Of Pachamama, with the concept of buen vivir. So there is, and these movements are in a way connected with a scholar concern with these non-human agencies, the way the world is constituted by more than, you know, human imagination, human construction of political concepts or whatever. So I think there is a huge space that has been, you know, created actively by some scholars, right? There is a huge space for more than human historians to do activism, to help people on the ground and be on the ground as well, you know, doing claims and you know, actually challenging some assumptions in court about the way we treat non-human beings. You know, does a river can a river be acknowledged as a subject of rights, or a forest, or an animal species, or whatever? I think this kind of discussion is ripe for. Actually, this is not the way to put it, because it is already being acted upon by more than human scholars, especially, and this is a case of success, I would say, in a way, in Australia, right? Much of the more than human discussion is coming for Australia for a good reason, because scholars there are engaging very intensely with Indigenous peoples. Well, a lot of them are Indigenous scholars, mm-hmm. right? And they are making bold claims about how to incorporate Indigenous cosmologies, which do recognize non-human beings and agents and as subjects of rights in the world, right? So yeah, that's my argument. There is a huge space for activism there.
Thank you so much, Hugo, for being with us today.
Thank you so much. That's my pleasure. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Foraging. This episode has been recorded and edited by Yorgos Patsis. I would like to thank the Foragency team members for their contributions, Thijs Kosters, Etienne Gontard, Alice Vittoria, and Peter Lamberts, as well as the Shock Research Group and the Vrije Universiteit Brussels. Foraging is made possible thanks to the European Research Council funding of the Foragency project. We hope that you enjoyed this episode and that you will join us soon for further conversations.